for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star 1 on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the call over to Jackie Glaze. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's Allstate call. I'll now turn to Calder, and he'll provide updates for today's call and also introduce our guest speaker. So, Calder?
Thank you, Jackie. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today as we move into our now weekly cadence for the Allstate call. Today, we have another presentation from our Lessons from the Field series before we also will have, of course, time to answer any questions that you have. As many of you know, the CARES Act and supplement legislation have designated $2.2 trillion in funding to address issues related to the COVID-19 pandemic. We spent some time, of course, talking about the Provider Relief Fund efforts, but there's also other funding in the bill that many areas that we know states have been working to address. For example, the bill included over $12 billion in appropriations to HUD to address housing issues such as rental assistance and emergency shelters. There was $19 billion appropriated for immediate relief for food support through the creation of the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. But in today's presentation, we'll spend some time learning more about one piece of the legislation's appropriations, which is nearly $1 billion in CARES Act funding that was directed to the Administration for Community Living, or ACL, one of our sister agencies here at HHS. So joining us today are Kelly Cronin and Vicki Gottlich from ACL. Kelly is the Deputy Administrator for the Center for Innovation and Partnership at ACL, and Vicki is the Director of ACL's Center for Policy and Evaluation. For those not familiar with the ACL, HHS created this operating division in 2012 by combining the Administration on Aging, the Office on Disability, and the Administration on Developmental Disabilities. ACL serves as the federal agency responsible for increasing access to community supports while focusing attention and resources on the unique needs of older Americans and people with disabilities across the lifespan. So like many of you as state Medicaid agencies and your sister agencies that operate state units on aging or other aging and disability programs, CMS and ACL share a close federal relationship as we serve many of the same beneficiaries. That's why we invited Kelly and Vicki to join us this afternoon to discuss the nearly $1 billion in funding that ACL programs will be administering through the CARES Act. These new investments in ACL programs will provide significant supports to older adults and people with disabilities, populations served by your state Medicaid programs. Kelly and Vicki will describe the support being provided through the CARES Act funding and discuss how state Medicaid agencies can work with your ACL-funded counterparts. After their presentation, we'll have a brief discussion with Kelly and Vicki about their work in this area, and then we'll open up the lines for questions on new CARES Act funding of these ACL programs. And as always, we will take your questions on any topics. I know one topic we've, of course, had recurring questions about has been with regard to application of Section 6083 of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act and the maintenance of effort requirements that are tied to the condition of receiving enhanced FMAP. We are still working through a number of those questions as it relates to petty obligations and other maintenance of effort requirements. So we don't have any new information on those questions to share today, but it is the top of our list. That we're working to get additional guidance out on as soon as possible so that we can answer those questions. So I did want to flag that up front. Also, as a general reminder, I wanted to provide a quick update on the Provider Relief Fund request that we made of many states to help support the department's efforts to make Provider Relief Fund payments to Medicaid and CHIP providers. Nearly all state and territories have submitted data files to CMS, and we expect to receive data files from the remaining states and territories very soon. I do want to call leadership, Medicaid leadership's attention to some of the data quality challenges that our teams are actively working to address with your state teams. In some states' files, there continue to be a high rate of missing data in certain fields. In some cases, corrupted data files that have prohibited our ability to intake the data or the file coming in the incorrect format. Your teams have been very responsive as we've worked to correct these issues. And to address them so that those files can be resubmitted so that they can be made actionable. But for all of the state Medicaid and CHIP directors on this call, I would just ask you check in with your technical teams to make sure that your state has submitted to us a clean and complete file and if not, that your team is actively working with us to address any data anomalies as quickly as possible. We want to ensure that we can deliver this data to HRSA and HHS, who are administering the Provider Relief Fund, to facilitate their efforts to distribute further provider payments as quickly as possible. I appreciate all of your responsiveness in submitting us these data quickly and accurately, as we know it was a very short turnaround request on our part. With that, I'll now turn it over to Kelly and Vicki to begin the presentation.
Thank you, Calder. This is Kelly Cronin from ACL. Excuse me. And I'm just going to start by giving just a very brief overview of what's in the CARES Act with respect to what's sort of leveraging the existing authorities under the Older Americans Act. So a lot of our programs that fund home and community-based services and can address some of the needs for older adults during the COVID-19 response really do stem from our existing programs. So a lot of this is supplemental funding, building on what already exists across the Aging and Disability Network. And I think, as Calder just explained, ACL was formed roughly 8 years ago by combining these different agencies. So the Aging Network that's been in existence since 1965 has evolved, under the Old Americans Act and through the federal-state partnership and a lot of state investment on top of this federal investment, so that we do have this nationwide infrastructure and network of community-based organizations that reach every community in the country. So it is an important time to be leveraging this asset, and with the additional resources that I'll give a quick overview of, we hope that it can continue to provide support to Medicaid beneficiaries. And we really appreciate the opportunity to be talking with all of you about how, together these investments can better serve people in need during this crisis. So just to start and break down how the roughly $950 million is being distributed, there's about $200 million for home and community-based services, which will help older adults shelter in place and to minimize their exposure to COVID-19. So this includes personal care assistance, help with household chores, grocery shopping, transportation to essential services, such as grocery stores or banks or doctors, or in many cases, it's often not the doctor now, as we know that telehealth is really sort of the main way of receiving care, at least outpatient care. And as necessary, this funding also will cover the cost of case management. So a big chunk of the funding is roughly $500 million is for home-delivered meals for older adults. And I think we're probably all acutely aware of the food insecurity issues that many older adults are facing now. The demand has really skyrocketed over the last 8 weeks. We know from recent Meals on Wheels surveys that the demands have increased by 74% per week. So I think overall, the Aging Network is doing their very best to keep up with these increased demands, which have really yielded 56% increase in the number of meals that are being delivered and expanded to 22% more seniors. And that was even data from back in March. So this increased demand has meant that these additional CARES Act resources are really needed. But we also know that it's increased the wait list. So the wait list nationwide has actually grown 26% over where it used to be. So while these additional resources are really important and allowing for flexibility to deliver meals in ways that minimizes contact, it really is addressing part of the need. So roughly $480 million of the $500 million are going to these home-delivered meals, which, again, can be through flexible means, so drive-through or grab-and-go meals for older adults. And many of those were previously participating at congregate meals where they would have the opportunity to meet at a community center. but because of social distancing, that's no longer available. So there's a lot of flexibility in how to get the meals to them through this funding. And we know many states have been very resourceful in figuring out how they do that, how they also partner with restaurants. There's many states that have been successful in trying to implement that. And then $20 million out of that $500 million is going towards Native American programs to help tribes and tribal organizations provide meals and supportive services directly to Native American elders. So that's 500 of the 950 total. And then the next bigger bucket is for $100 million to support the National Family Caregiving Support Program. That expands a range of services that help family and informal caregivers provide support for their loved ones at home. So this includes counseling, respite care, training, connecting people to information and resources, and other supports. And I think we all know a lot of caregiving in this country is provided informally through family members, friends, and neighbors. So it's knowing that 85% of all this support is through this network, we think this kind of support and the expansion of this support is really needed, particularly when we're trying to keep people safe and supported at home and avoid institutional care. And then additional $20 million is available now to support state long-term care ombudsman programs. So they provide consumer advocacy services for residents in long-term care facilities across the country. As you know, the restrictions on visitation have really increased the demand for these ombudsman services. Families are seeking assistance to ensure the well-being of their loved ones. And these programs are really trying to expand their virtual presence. With the restrictions in place, they still want to have contact and be aware of what's happening. They want to know the well-being of the residents, the issues, and be able to play a constructive role in representing their interests and promote the health, safety, their welfare, and the rights of those residents in the context of this emergency response. So this program will allow the ombudsman programs the flexibility they need to hire additional staff, purchase technology to allow for this virtual connection, and also allow them PPE once they are allowed to do in-person visits again. So beyond that, we have $50 million for aging and disability resource centers. They are grants being administered at the state level, so states have flexibility on how they will disseminate those funds. But they are intended to connect people that are at the greatest risk of COVID-19 to services that are needed, and focusing also on important issues like how to address social isolation, or how do we support care coordination and care transitions, knowing that we really would like to keep people safe and supported at home, but for those who need skilled nursing facility care or hospital-based care, it's important that they are supported in a person-centered way through those transitions, and their preferences and their values and their needs are really looked at in a holistic way. So, you know, roughly 50% of the aging network is already actively contracting with healthcare organizations to provide this kind of care transition support. We also know that the long-term care industry is in significant need of this support and are working with them to help with provide that. So the ADRC funding, we think, will help not only allow the state to support the local ADRCs, particularly those that are in hotspots, who really need more staff and more support and more technology. They have the flexibility to address the needs that are most pressing, but really to figure out how do we sustain a robust access system so that the right kind of planning and service navigation and case management can be available during this emergency response. So that's a quick overview of the bigger categories of the funding. With the exception of those that pertain to the disability side, which Vicki was going to give an overview. So I'll turn it to her, and then I think we're going to then transition to some questions.
Thanks, Kelly. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the disability programs funded by ACL. I'm going to give you an overview of those programs. So really, it was only the Centers for Independent Living that received funding under the CARE Act. So on the state level, we have state councils on developmental disabilities, the DD councils, that exist in every state and territory, and they actually are supposed to identify gaps in services and implement strategies to address the needs of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities on a statewide level. The DD councils participate in state and local emergency management councils, and they assist in channeling resources towards needs post-disaster. Right now, DD councils are working within their state to help prioritize PPE and to help get families supplies so that families can stay together and that families can understand the state resources. The other statewide leadership entity that ACL has and works with is the Statewide Independent Living Councils, or SILCs. These SILCs serve individuals with all kinds of significant disabilities, not just intellectual and developmental disabilities. They collaborate with the Centers for Independent Living in each state or territory and help plan and coordinate activities and services that are beneficial to individuals. When activities or services are disrupted, the SILC may help identify gaps and barriers to service and help develop possible ways to remedy them. SILCs are also charged with writing the statewide plan for independent living, and part of that plan is to coordinate with other entities that are serving the same population. That could include, of course, the Medicaid state office and local Medicaid offices. On a community basis, we fund the protection and advocacy systems. These serve individuals with all types of disabilities, and they provide a range of legal advocacy services to protect the rights of individuals with disabilities. They address allegations of neglect or abuse and conduct monitoring and investigations of facilities. Their disaster activities may include contacting people with disabilities to assess status and needs, provide technical assistance or referral services, providing case management, ensuring access to services, and providing legal expertise to state and federal agencies and hospitals. In the COVID times, they are looking at the need for PPE in hospitals and care facilities, many of the protection and advocacy organizations were involved in the efforts to address discriminatory provisions in crisis standards of care, which the HHS Office for Civil Rights addressed. We also have university centers for excellence in developmental disabilities. The USAD serve individuals with developmental disabilities and their families. Their disaster activities may include serving as subject matter experts on people with disabilities, deploying DD experts to areas of great need, ensuring the restoration of assistive technology, research and resource development, providing case management, and they're working right now on assistance in remote care and family support. The recipients of the CARE Act money are the Centers for Independent Living. They were awarded $85 million that go to the 354 SIL grantees. SILs serve people with a wide array of significant disabilities, and they serve people of all ages. So about 30 to 35% of the people they serve are over 60. They are providing coordination of accessible housing and transportation services. They're contacting their clients to assess their current needs and their status. They're working to coordinate services. They're addressing and helping to find mobility equipment, medication, medical supplies. They're assisting with the shortage of personal care, attendance services, ASL interpreters. Unlike on the aging side, the disability side doesn't have any direct funding to provide food to address food insecurities. So the SILS could use some of the new CARES Act dollars to assist with food distribution and other supplies. They can use the money to assist with transportation and generally to help people live independently in the community. Again, the SILS are working to address the need for PPE and also to address the need to provide remote services to people with disabilities. And I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Calder so we can discuss some of the questions that he has.
Thank you so much for that overview. I know that these have been topics that a lot of folks have been interested in, so it's helpful to hear some of your work on getting those resources out into the states. I think we'll turn it over to the operator to open up the line for questions for our ACL partners on this topic, and then once we complete that, we can turn to more general question topics. So, operator, can you give instructions?
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly. Your name is required to introduce your question. It does take a few moments for the questions to come through.
While we wait for some of the questions to queue up, maybe I can just ask a quick one. What is the best way, do you think, Kelly and Vicki, for the state Medicaid agencies to understand which of the sort of the SILS, the ADRCs, the area agencies on their state receive funding through these extra grants?
The most efficient way. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Vicki.
Kelly, you start, and then I'll fill in.
Okay. The most efficient way to figure out how the funds are being used in the state and how they're being distributed is to really figure out through the state lead, which is in all cases but the SILS going to be the state as the grantee recipient. It's in most cases the state unit on aging that would be able to identify who is receiving funding at a community level if there's interest in knowing sort of how it's being distributed at a county or community level. All that information is posted on our website. We'd be happy to provide that hyperlink. The SILS were funded directly, and we can also give you the list of awardees so that, you know, if anyone wanted to know within their geography, within their state, where was the money going, we can provide that to them. I would say the only exception in terms of the ADRC grants is that 5 grantees are going to be the University Centers of Excellence on Disability, where it was just they had a statewide reach, and they're going to be the No Wrong Door lead entity for the state. So those 5 grantees are the exception on the ADRC side. Everything else is pretty much the state unit on aging or a Center for Independent Living as the grantee recipient.
Great.
Yeah,
another option
may be to contact the Statewide Independent Living Council. There are some SILS, it gets complicated, who don't receive money directly from ACL. They didn't get the additional funding, but they still get funding from ACL that comes not directly to them, but comes to them through the state. So the SILS would have all that information.
Great. Well, we'll collect those links, I think, and maybe we can follow up after the call to provide those to folks if they want to dig in deeper on their state level. So, operator, do we have any questions queued up?
I have no questions at this time.
Okay. We'll give folks just another minute. Maybe I could just ask one more. From your perspective, tell us how you see the SILS or others utilizing these funds, or how can they be utilized? You talked a little bit about it, but I think it's helpful to understand, you know, what's the difference between where funds are being utilized to sort of coordinate and link services versus providing direct service supports. How can they be kind of used together to with other funding streams like Medicaid?
Vicki, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Yeah, I'll start. So SILS have five core services that they're supposed to provide, information and referral, independent living skills training, peer counseling, systems advocacy, and individual advocacy that could include trying to get PPE to the right venues. And one of the other big functions that they serve are facilitating the transition from nursing homes and other institutions to the community, which seems to be a big important issue at the moment. It could be transitioning folks from one congregate setting, like a group home, to another congregate setting or another less restrictive setting. SILS also provide other services that could actually include personal assistance services. Some SILS provide transportation. Some SILS provide rehabilitation technology. So it's going to depend really on the community need. The point is that the SILS are community run, and they're run by primarily individuals with significant disabilities. So they're going to look to see what is the greatest need within their community. Kelly, you want to add?
Yeah, I would also add that I think one of the strengths of the Aging and Disability Network is to be able to braid funding streams. And I think also many of Medicaid directors on the phone or Medicaid staff are probably very familiar that under waiver services, AAAs or ADRCs are often supporting with getting access to waiver services. So given that there's, in some cases, already in a relationship there, knowing how to go beyond what a given Medicaid service offering might be to address other needs that could be funded through the Older Americans Act. So if there's additional transportation or additional food needs, nutrition needs, or transportation or home modifications, or they're housing insecure, and those aren't, there's needs beyond what's covered under a waiver or under a Medicaid managed care plan or under an integrated care, like a duals program, there is the ability for a case manager or person-centered planner to look more holistically at their needs and think beyond covered benefits and bring in the money from the Older Americans Act or from the Rehab Act or from these other funding sources. It could also be local or county-based or philanthropy, and really bring all those sources to bear to meet the holistic needs. So we do think that that's one of the strengths, and particularly in this emergency response, we're hearing from some very large health plans that are, you know, sort of dominant in the Medicaid managed care space, where they are flat out trying to address food insecurity and housing instability and many other needs, but they would very much like to be in more lockstep or more coordination with the Aging and Disability Network and local resources. I think everyone is just trying to rapidly respond the needs at hand in the best way they can. But, you know, it's almost like we have an opportunity before we get to wave two to figure out what is that blending and braiding look like and how can we make that easier at a local level.
That's a great point, and I'm sure will be a subject of a lot of continued conversation. Let's just check in real quick to see if we've got any audience questions before we move on. Operator, is there anything in the queue?
I have no audio questions.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Kelly and Vicki, for joining us today. It was really helpful to get this information and be able to share it with our state partners. We will follow up to provide some of those links that they mentioned to some of the information about where those funds have been allocated. And we certainly encourage folks to, you know, have those conversations at the local level, and we'll certainly continue to share information as we have it. All right. So I think we're going to, Jackie, you're going to take it over to transition us to the next stage of the meeting.
Yes, thank you, Calder. So, Denise, we're ready to open up the line so the audience can ask any general questions that they may have. So we're ready to take the questions at this point.
It is star one if anyone would like to ask a question. I do have a question from Ada Asuna. Your line is open.
Hello. This is Ada Asuna. I have a question regarding PETI again. The latest update to the FAQs provided guidance on PETI modifications. It said that states claiming the temporary FMAP increase are prohibited from increasing the liability for individuals receiving long-term care services and supports. I was wondering if an individual is voluntarily asking for their liability to increase, is this something that is permitted?
Interesting question. We'll add that to the list. It does allow for voluntary termination. The statute doesn't specifically, this is Sarah DeLone, doesn't specifically speak to voluntarily increasing PETI. But let us, as Calder said in the beginning, we are taking a look at, a whole range of PETI issues and apologize that it's difficult stuff to work through, but we will add that to our consideration and are really working as hard as we can to get out the guidance that we fully understand you all really need.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. Do you guys have any timelines on when this will be available to us, this answers?
We're working as quickly as we can, but I don't have a specific date in mind. We are cognizant of how eager states are needing or how much you're needing this guidance, so we are trying to get it resolved as quickly as we can. And apologize.
Okay, thank you very much.
That it's taking us time, yeah.
No, I completely understand. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
And as a reminder, it is star one if anyone would like to have their line open. I'm showing no questions at this time.
Let's just give it a moment to see if we have a late-breaking question trickle in. So no additional questions?
No additional questions.
Okay, well then perhaps the best thing we can do is give folks a little bit of time back on their calendar. If there are topics that folks would like to see focused on in these calls or covered now that we're moving to a weekly basis, perhaps those ideas and suggestions and requests could get funneled up. Maybe the NAD would agree to take that and let us know. We want this to continue to be a useful time for everyone and to bring together information that would be helpful. We certainly understand the urgency on getting additional questions answered on the PETI and other 6083 issues. They are complex. We want to make sure we're giving good guidance and that we're trying to get states, the flexibility where we can and where it makes sense. But they are complex legal issues. So I appreciate everyone's patience. Thank you for joining us today and have a good rest of the week.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time. Speakers, allow a moment of silence and stand by for your post-conference.